Thanks for tuning into the Bulwark Podcast. Today is Thursday, August 2nd, and I'm joined here with three special guests. It's a MegaCast. We have Jonathan V. Last, who's our executive editor.
Hi, Jim.
We have Sarah Longwell, who is our publisher and newly verified on Twitter.
Thanks to you, Jim.
And joining us from the far hinterland of California is our contributor, Tim Miller. Tim.
Congratulations on that blue check, Sarah. You've come such a long way.
It was a long time coming, I'm telling you.
You've been toiling on Twitter for years.
For approximately 13 months, I've been on Twitter.
See, so you missed one of the great running jokes on Twitter, which was the years that we had where John Podhoretz would freak out about not having a blue check mark. It's happened for years. It was like this great running joke.
Why didn't he have one?
I don't know. Twitter was stingy with them. But it was fabulous. And it got to the point where I actually sort of secretly thought that Twitter knew it. They knew about his bitching about it and was withholding it just because they got off on watching him like flip it. Where's my blue check mark? And then like when Crystal got verified before John got verified, because Crystal got verified after like 3 days on Twitter and John went nuts. John was like, wah! And to be honest, a little part of me died.
I miss J-Pod on Twitter.
I know.
I
a little part of me
I'm
died when John got verified.
Health.
Well, I don't want to act like I didn't care about the blue check mark. I didn't like need
some people
the blue
do.
Mm-hmm.
Some people really
sure,
care.
I only asked Jim about it six or seven times if he could figure out how to get me that blue check mark.
It's it really is instructive to think about how in kindergarten everything's motivated by stickers, and you think, why did I care so much about that damn sticker? Then we become adults and we just want that little blue check mark right next to the name.
Yeah. I don't think it's made me a better person, but I've got it now.
You're probably nicer on Twitter.
Maybe. No, I immediately blew it with like kind of a lousy tweet right after I got it where I like misread something.
Yeah, it happens. Today's podcast is brought to you by NetSuite. We'll hear more from them in a little bit. But since it's Thursday, and clearly we were up late on Twitter.com talking about the second Democratic debate last night. What were your takeaways from that, Tim?
I was on West Coast time. Everything's better out here. It was over at a very reasonable hour. I was able to have a post-debate bourbon and really kind of let it marinate before I had to go to bed. But my main takeaway is this. I'm just flabbergasted by the strategic approach of basically every candidate in the primary, and particularly on the stage last night. I want to say without hyperbole that the first 52 minutes of the debate last night were a kind of snippy and bitter back and forth about the various particulars of the healthcare policies of the people on stage. And, you know, and while healthcare obviously is important and impacts a lot of people, I have a tough time understanding why, as a strategic matter, bickering about healthcare white papers helps you either in a primary, where I don't think the primary voters care about the particulars of it that much, or that it helps you in a general election against Donald Trump, where, you know, you're giving him reams and reams of video of your fellow Democrats calling you extreme or stupid or not covering enough people. Donald Trump's not going to give any details of his healthcare policy. You know, he's going to say, best policy ever. And that's it. Like, you know, we're going to do the best policy ever. We're going to do the best healthcare ever, the lowest prices ever. That's all he said. So why are these candidates bickering about this? And then it went over all the way through the 3 hours. I mean, I think Tulsi Gabbard and a number of other candidates were more familiar with the Joe Biden and Kamala Harris oppo file than they were with the Trump oppo file. And so it is mystifying to me why they're not focused on connecting with the audience and with the primary audience and with their loathing of Donald Trump first and foremost, and then focusing their contrasts on him first and foremost, and making internecine contrasts really secondary and tertiary to that. That seems like the obvious strategy to me. Maybe I'm missing something because I'm not seeing enough internal poll numbers, but I thought everybody was a loser last night
Tim, that account. It's JVL. I'm going to ask you something about this because I was deeply interested. Last night, I felt like I had the scales fall from my eyes in that I finally understood what it is that attracts Democrats to the idea of outlawing private health insurance. And what I took from it was that they want to do it not as a matter of positive policy, but as a way of punishing health insurance companies. That it's sort of the main attraction. Now, I'm sure there is some, if Ezra Klein was here, he would spend 50 minutes educating me on how, well, actually, in order for the exchanges to work, you have to blah, 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 blah. But the political attraction of it is to punish health insurance companies who they hate.
Joe Biden wants to put the CEOs in jail.
Well, you know, I mean, only before you can execute them.
That was the moderate take on the panel. No, I think that that's right.
But here's the question, though. Is that poll-driven? I mean, I would assume it is, except in the case of Bernie and Warren. I mean, I just assume that Bernie and Warren have that view organically.
But I don't think this is right. I mean, you hear them say this. I know you asked Tim this, but just on one quick point, you do hear them say all the time, well, I talk to people who are so upset by health insurance, who feel like they don't get what they need. But if you look at any poll around private health insurance, what people tell you, it's like 82% would say that their private health insurance is either great or good. And so I think it is a myth that people sort of hate private health insurance. I'm sure they don't like paying deductibles and some of the premiums and other things, but I don't think that people, I don't believe there's a massive outcry against private health insurance.
Well, there's also right? I mean, this is the big, if what you want to do is convince the country to take a flyer on single payer, saying that, you know, hey, you've got this private health insurance, which in some cases you like quite a lot, in some cases you like a little bit, and in some cases you're deeply unhappy with. But we're going to replace it and not give you any recourse to anything else and only have one plan and just trust us it's going to be great. That's a really big ask for voters, isn't it?
Yeah, I think so. And I agree with you on the genuineness of it. I mean, look, Cory Booker was like palling around with these insurance execs, like, you know, because a lot of them are based in New Jersey. That was, you know, his home donor base for a long time. I don't think outside of Bernie that this is genuine. I do think as a matter of polling and as a matter of being in touch with the electorate, insurance company executives, particularly those that are not covering sympathetic people going through health issues, are an easy boogeyman. And I think that that's a fine thing to talk about. I think Sarah kind of teased Biden about his comment about jailing them. I think that, like, the idea behind that is right. His execution was a little weird, of, you know, holding these executives accountable, like making sure there's fairness, making sure there's government oversight. Like, that all seems pretty popular. Like, to Sarah's point, people like their plan, but maybe don't like health insurance companies, don't like certain unfair situations. Like, that all seems fine. This is reminiscent of the immigration debate, which I'm sure we could talk about too, which is like they're trading in very popular policy positions that are on left of center that might not be the ideal policy positions for the four of us, and for no reason, throwing them in the trash and taking up very risky, potentially unpopular policies, and then fighting about that amongst themselves and name calling. So, I think you're right about what is the emotional side of what is driving this. I think there's also, Jonathan, an element of, you know, Elizabeth Warren has gotten so much traction for being the one with ideas and the one with plans that there's kind of a copycat effect going on here, where they feel like the kinds of voters that they hear from, the highly educated Democratic liberal kind of base that is highly engaged, do care about this sort of thing, but I think that they're really missing the forest from the trees on it.
Sarah and Tim, I have a question for both of you, which is I think we would all agree that we have essentially five top tier candidates. Is that right? Biden, Kamala, Mayor Pete, Warren, and Bernie. Yeah. Would we?
And Marianne, five and a half.
And Marianne. Do you think that anybody else is going to be able to break into the top tier? And if so, who do you think is most likely to do it?
I think that Booker maybe still has an outside chance. I mean, if he's the person he was last night, as opposed to the person he can, there's a less likable version of him that you can get acquainted with sometimes. I think he's got a chance. He's going to be on the stage in September, so he's still in the hunt right now. There's seven of them, and I think there's a couple more that are kind of on the tipping point. So I think people who are kind of advancing to the next round could still potentially get there. But if I had to bet money, I'd bet on those five.
Yeah, same. Booker, I think, is the only one. I think that there is. I would not bet on this, but I think there's a non-zero possibility that Biden's performance at some point in an upcoming debate is so poor that his numbers really tank. And there's a question of, is there somebody that could fill that void? I think Kamala is the obvious person, which is why, you know, she's targeting him to be able to take on, I guess there are two elements of his vote share, the blue collar white voters and then the African-American voters. I think you can imagine a scenario where, you know, Booker is kind of like a John Kerry in 2004 situation where he's an affable, you know, everybody likes him. You know, he meets a minimum threshold of, you know, qualifications and likability, and, you know, Kamala and Biden, you know, sort of beat each other up, and he takes on that, you know, African-American vote and the kind of mainstream Obama Democratic vote. I think it's a long shot at this point, but I don't think that's totally out of the question. But besides that, I guess Oprah or Michelle Obama would be the only other people I would say could get into the top tier.
Here's a question for the panel. You know, as the debates keep going, you know, every month or however often they're going to have them until they have their nominee, they're using these standards to sort of restrict who gets on the debate stage, which is good because, you know, you don't want Mike Gravel on the stage because, you know, that's a joke. The Alaska senator, former Alaska senator, for those who are not familiar. Do you think that it is really going to prompt some of these candidates to drop out if they repeatedly don't make the stage? Or are there going to be some people like John Delaney who are still going to be running for president, even if they're not the nominee the day before the election? Because I don't mean to joke, because Delaney's been running for this.
It seems to me that there is like kind of a broad middle that's going to get squeezed. You know, I think Gillibrand, probably Castro, unless, you know, he has a bump that I didn't foresee from his performance last night. You know, Beto is going to have a lot of pressure on him to enter the Senate race, I think. I think a lot of those folks get out.
Klobuchar
probably eventually. You know, then you have the issue candidates. You know, I mean, like, what's the point of getting out if you're Jay Inslee, right? Like, you're just out there to become, you know, the next Al Gore, famous climate change person. Why not stick around? So I think that, you know, there will be some hangers on, but that the debate rules will probably, will definitely squeeze the field down somewhat.
Some Lloyd Christmas candidates. You're saying there's a chance.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, the only other dynamic I guess I could see potentially shifting is that, you know, one of my early theories about the field was that you were going to see Biden, that there were going to be a lot more people in the moderate lane than there are, that Biden and Beto and Buttigieg and Kamala would all kind of be splitting a more reasonable vote, and that was going to leave. And at the time, you know, Warren was really fading. And so there was this idea that I had that they were going to kind of split the reasonable vote and Bernie was going to be alone and kind of burn it all down lane. And that was going to be able to allow him to run up a plurality. But what's happened is the field has lurched to the left. There's actually a splitting of the votes on the progressive side, and that Kamala has sort of made, I think, a dubious decision to run more on that side than on the Biden side. And so I guess it's conceivable that if Biden did start to fade and Kamala is still, for some reason, running too far to the left, that either like a Bennett, I don't know, I thought Bennett had a great night. I thought Delaney had a good night.
Yeah. Same.
One of those guys could sort of...
All four of us can buy Bennett shirts.
And, exactly.
You know, we can caucus for them.
Yeah, but, you know, but we only like them because their politics are our politics.
That's true. I guess the question is whether or not there would open up a little more space to kind of get to 4 or 5% in that kind of moderate lane.
Well, I think they need to maybe pick the moderates need to kind of pick one, right? Because one takeaway I got from watching both debates was that the kind of mainstream 5 or 7 or however you want to count it, they were all attacking the moderates. You know, I joked multiple times this week on the podcast that Delaney was living rent free inside of Elizabeth Warren's head. But I was sort of shocked to see almost all of the kind of, you know, front runners just nailing the moderates left and right.
But that's because the moderates are standing for Biden. I mean, this is the other reason. Biden is simply eating up all of these. If Biden were to get hit by a bus tomorrow, God forbid, then I think you would see some portion of his support, you know, maybe 10% of his support, sprinkle out between Hickenlooper, Bennett, whoever the other, Bullock, Delaney, et cetera. But then a lot of it would go back towards, you know, well, who can beat, you know, who else is leading Trump, right? I mean, there's going to be a portion of that. So, Tim and Jim, Sarah and I were talking before the show on our other show. We were having a discussion about how early or late it is right now. Sarah seems to think that it is actually quite early. There's a lot of time. Anything can happen. My argument is that actually it's very late. We are like 30 weeks out from Iowa. We are in the dog days of summer where you can just like lop 5 weeks off of the calendar right there, in that things are much more gelled than we think otherwise. Do you guys have a view one way or another on this?
I don't think it's very late, but I guess I would side more on the late part than the early. I think that if you look back at the other kind of surprise elections that we've had in the last 12 years with Obama in 2008 and Trump in 2016, both of them were winning by now, right? They seemed surprising, at the beginning for in Obama's case, and then still at the end because of Trump, because we're deluding ourselves. The data showed, basically what ended up happening already by about this time, in the equivalent cycle. So, I think obviously news cycles are changing. Trump has changed the game a little bit. I think that there is opening for some movement. I also Biden is a big question mark. I think Trump had this lead and was, everybody was surprised at how he was able to sustain it. We might be overcorrecting on that this time by kind of assuming that Biden, is not going to be able to do that. But, I think that Biden is a question mark, and it's about a third of the electorate that, for whatever reason, the bottom fell out from under him, could really change the dynamics. But other than that, I think we're pretty late.
Tim, can you think of a party nominee who has won the nomination and not been in the lead at some point by this point in the cycle?
Is that a question?
I'm pretty sure both of you.
I don't think Bill Clinton was.
Maybe not.
And I'm actually... Maybe not.
I have to go
Tim,
back and
Tim
look.
Tim would know better than I, yeah, I guess, but I'm not entirely sure that Barack Obama was.
I guess that's right. It would be Clinton and Obama. I can't think
of
it.
So Dole was in the lead by this point. By the summer. Yeah, Biden had taken, or I'm sorry, Obama had taken the lead by the summer. I'm almost certain. I don't have it in front of me. Okay.
I'm going to take the Goldilocks position here. It's not earlier, or not too early, not too late. It's just right. We're right in the very, very middle of this. And I do agree, and I haven't listened to Sarah's point on the other show that will not be named, but anything could happen. Michelle Obama, and I think, Tim, you wrote about this for us. Michelle Obama, Oprah. Someone could jump into this race and make it a bombshell and just really just blow the doors off.
But Michelle is unlikely because Biden is leading. Yeah. I mean, this is the other, in a weird way, like Biden takes that piece off the table, because she is one of the people who I think the three of you probably agree that if Michelle Obama announced this afternoon that she was going to run for president,
destroy the whole field.
A week from now, she's in first place. Yeah. And she is certainly the nominee, and I would be willing to bet $1,000 she beats Trump.
Yeah, it'd be like if Biden World privately went to Obama and, they found out that, he had a month to live, God forbid, or something. And they didn't want to announce this because they wanted it. I mean, it would be coordinated. She would not come in and shiv Biden. It would be to save Biden.
Yeah, if he found out he was sick or something like that.
Yeah, or if he was just bleeding support, right? Like if he just had another couple bungles like the rope line where he reversed his opinion on a long-held thing like the Hyde Amendment, right? If he's just started really just tanking the campaign, either on purpose or by mistake or just due to other forces, you think Obama Biden world would come in with some sort of plan to?
Yeah.
Just really quick, Sarah, sorry to interrupt you. As much as we can think, it's hard to think about, late emerging nominees. It's easy to think about like people who were supposed to shake up the race and came in and did and failed. Right. I mean, like, look, pundits like us need stuff to talk about in August before the election. Right. Now, Fred Thompson, Wesley Clark. I mean, there's a reason oftentimes why the people who haven't gotten in, who could shake things up, don't get in. And often it's because they don't actually have the skills to make it happen.
Yeah, and then speaking of where we are in the timeline and whether or not things get, you know, shaken up, one of the things that struck me about the debates, both sets of debates, is that Kamala's maybe the only person who had a kind of like breakout, it moved her poll numbers type deal. You know, Elizabeth Warren's been kind of picking up a point every few weeks steadily, but there's Joe Biden is so steady at this point that and the Sanders and Warren splitting that progressive vote, it just seems like he you pointed this out in your letter. He's running in the general already. Like, it is possible this thing is locked up at this point and the rest of it's just performance.
Yeah, I think that pundits are understating the Biden's resilience.
Not
that pundit, but I get called all the time still about like the Biden Jeb comparison. I'm like, Jeb was already at 9% by now. You know, like Biden has a lot of resilience, you know, a much stronger floor of support than a lot of the people that people try to compare him to negatively in past campaigns. And I think that this week will really be telling, because I mean, he took punches from everybody last night. It was relentless. Booker, Kamala, you know, all the people on the edge of the stage, de Blasio, over and over again, obnoxiously. And if he doesn't lose any points, at some point it's got to stick. Your point, Sarah, that like, you know, there really is something here. That the pundits are missing, because, you know, most of Biden's support is from people who aren't, you know, on blue check Twitter with Sarah Longwell.
That's the thing. It's not knocking him out, but it's also not elevating them to the point where they can.
Right.
You're not seeing a breakout where you're like, oh, this person's really on the move. They're coming for him in a big way. Like that dynamic's not really there.
We're going to take a quick break here and get a word in from our sponsor. But a question for you guys to think about as we listen, do this lovely ad here. Who is the Scott Walker of this cycle right now? And more in a moment after a word from our sponsor. Today's podcast is brought to you by NetSuite. If you don't know your numbers, you don't know your business. But the problem growing businesses have that keeps them from getting to know their numbers is their hodgepodge of business systems. They have one system for accounting, another for sales, another for inventory, and so on. It's just a big, inefficient mess, taking up too much time and too many resources, and that hurts the bottom line. Introducing NetSuite by Oracle, the business management software that handles every aspect of your business in an easy-to-use cloud platform, giving you the visibility and control that you need to grow. With NetSuite, you will save time, money, and unneeded headaches by managing sales, finance, and accounting, orders, and HR instantly, right from your desktop or your phone. That's why NetSuite is the world's number one cloud business system. And right now, NetSuite is offering you, dear Bulwark listener, valuable insights with a free guide called 7 Key Strategies to Grow Your Profits at netsuite.com/bulwark. That's netsuite.com/bulwark. Go there and download your free guide, 7 Key Strategies to Grow Your Profits. Once again, netsuite.com/bulwark. So, who is the Scott Walker of this cycle?
Beto, right?
Yeah. I mean, totally.
Can I
or Klobuchar.
Can I complain about something? All right. So, I wrote on Wednesday night a 1,700-word piece about the first debate purely to get to a single joke, and I did not get a single damn email about it.
You mean you're talking about the skull and crossbones for Beto?
Yes.
I thought
so. I'm doing giant, like, you know, 4-paragraph analyses about every candidate as I am ranking them. The only reason I did this entire thing was so that at the very end I could have Beto's name, and then instead of anything else, just put the skull and crossbones emoji.
I think that makes you a millennial.
Isn't that hysterical? And nothing. I get nothing for that.
You know why? It's less funny than it is a trenchant observation. It's just right. It's right. It's just exactly on point.
Yeah. Sometimes the truth is not funny, or the truth has ceased to be funny because, you know, we've collectively lost our ability to laugh about the truth being funny.
And Beto is quickly, if it hasn't already happened, transitioning into mockable to kind of sad. You know, like, it's like, people who have, you know, soft, you know, mushy interiors like me, underneath my hard candy shell, start to get to the point where it's kind of hard to stomach teasing of Beto. I mean, he's still a super good-looking rich guy.
You know, like, and I mean, he can take crushed. It.
Who eats dirt?
Is he going to get out? Here's my question. Is he going to get out?
He has to before he can't even run against Cornyn. Yeah, I mean, his stock will be so low.
Don't you think his stock at this point is already almost too low to go run for Senate?
I think he should not. My view is that actually he should pass. He should leave to think about going for running for the Senate race, which gives him an excuse to get out, and then he should decide not to run.
I think that's right.
And then save yourself for another day, let your stock and the FOMO maybe catch up with you. Sort of like what Wendy Davis, I mean, she's running against Chip Roy in Texas 23, you know, after she kind of blew it.
Go take a cabinet position in the Biden administration and reinvent yourself on the national stage.
Yeah.
Or Trump wins re-election and, you know, run in his second midterm, right, in 2022 against whoever it would be up then, Cruz or governor race.
My initial answer for this was Booker, but after his debate performance, I will switch to the Beto camp because it was looking like Booker was going to be the Scott Walker.
But Booker never really registered. I mean, this is the thing, to be the Scott Walker, Scott Walker was in the lead for a hot minute.
Yeah, totally.
And none of this is why, like, Klobuchar, I mean, Beto actually shot up to like 14% for 5 minutes.
Yeah, that's true.
And the rest of these people never really showed up. Do you guys have any Tulsi Gabbard thoughts, everybody?
I think it's sick what she's doing. I mean, I think that, you know, you saw some Democratic operatives, you know, kind of try to stoke reporters' interest last night on Twitter into, you know, who is feeding Tulsi.
It's
you know,
Russian
the this sort of attacks, right? So the Russia,
Google.
Right? So
Google
so
who's the, feeding it. Like, it's not, you know, everybody who studies Kamala Harris
right?
has known that this is her weakness, right? Just nobody was willing to say it.
I guess, but she seemed very, you know, this was a prepped. I mean, you know, she was ticking off, you know, the Oppo book, you know, one after another, which leads me to believe that that probably Biden or Bernie are doing back channel. I mean, this is pretty common in primary campaigns. I mean, all these, you know, campaign managers know each other. You know, I mean, famously in 2008, you know, McCain and Huckabee kind of had a you know, wink and nod, you know, relationship vis-a-vis Romney. And so I think it's an interesting question about whether she you know, is kind of working with Biden or Bernie behind the scenes. I think that would be a very, very, very painful revelation for either of them. If that was true. But, you know, I worked for John Huntsman. If at the end of a primary debate, the people who are complimenting you are the partisans on the other side, like, you didn't have a good debate. So Tulsi, the fact that Tulsi is getting, you know, complimented by Brian Kilmeade or whatever, that's not a path to success.
Yeah, and you know the Tucker Carlsons of the world just love it.
Right.
But what does success for her look like though? Because she is primarily a non-intervention. I mean, to the extent that her campaign has a thing, she's like more Marianne Williamson than Marianne Williamson. She is, I mean, you know, non-interventionist. Like, that's her thing. And she is way further out to the left on foreign policy stuff than anybody else in the Democratic field.
She's going to be vice president during a Tucker Carlson presidency.
Maybe. No? Is that wrong? I mean, that's why I mean, she didn't have a debate. She did not have a good debate if her goal was to become the Democratic nominee in 2020. But I just assume that that's not actually her goal. And so
to become a Fox News contributor
or to be something, right? Look, she's a rep in Hawaii.
And she's probably
got to like get into national. She has to create a national profile and look like she's more than a pretty face. And I thought she looked like a very able attack dog. And
she could go the bow tie Harlan Hill route and become a token Democrat for Trump pundit on television. I don't know what her path is.
Speaking of strange alliances, Marianne Williamson has a lot of fanboys on the right, and not just because they might have like mom issues or whatever, but the kind of tradcath crowd, they just love Marianne Williamson. They just love it. Do you guys have any?
Is she big over at First Things?
Yeah.
Really?
I have thoughts
in that
crowd. I don't have thoughts on First Things. I think that Ross wrote something about this though, which, you know, in an increasingly secular country, really, and Democratic Party certainly, You know, having a candidate who, even if it's this sort of new wavy mysticism, you know, who seems earnest about, you know, believing that there's more, having a want for more, I can see how there's a connection with that from, Catholics and other kind of deeply held, you know, belief Christians who sort of want there to be support for this notion that this is like a basic human desire that is being abandoned on the left. So I get that. And I think that that's not really the appeal to her for me. But I mean, I wrote for Politico, and what my appeal to her as an anti-Trump Republican, which is opposite of the First Things guys, but it is, she really over two nights seemed to be the only person, I think, maybe Booker tried to do this, that talked about kind of the, you know, spiritual, emotional impact that Trump is having on the country. And I think it's very bizarre that over four debates, you know, and 22 candidates, that Marianne Williamson and I guess Booker to a lesser degree are the only ones that are talking about that, because I think that's something that resonates with people. There are a lot of people who don't care so much about the policies as they're sick of what Trump is doing to their communities. So, I think that, you know, she has a lot of different vectors for where her kind of kooky appeal is, but I think those are two of them.
Sarah, your eyes are going to roll into the back of your head as we're talking about fluffing Marianne Williamson.
I cannot stand this idea that people are suddenly taking this woman, even ironically, sort of seriously. Like, this is an anti-vaxxer. You know, she goes out, she's like got a lot of shaming that she does of specific groups of people. Like, she's a crank. And I noticed, Tim, on Twitter that you were, what I hope was ironically, wearing her shirt during the first debate.
I did. Well, it's funny. I was ironically wearing your shirt because it's a great shirt. And so I hope everybody just looks at the JVL can appreciate this.
I ironically wore the Trump hat. Got to be careful what you wish for.
That's true. That was a big mistake on your part, Jim. I guess I would rather have the Marianne type of crazy than the Trump crazy, if you know you're putting a gun to my head. But I think that's a fair warning. But the shirt is excellent.
Harness love.
The design is hilarious. It's like a picture of her. I can't even describe it. You really just have to look at it on my Twitter, on Marianne2020.com. It's amazing. But I was wearing it ironically. And then the debate started. And I have to say, like, her answer about what Trump is doing to this country with regards to race, and her answer with what Trump is doing to this country with regarding to how he's impacting our communities, and the need to respond to that in a big way, in a moral way, in an emotional way, and not in a policy way, she was right. So, I don't want her to be president of the United States. I think it's a cool shirt, but I think that I'm hoping that somebody else on the stage can learn from that and can take from that. I mean, again, I would have said the same thing about Trump in 2016. Say what you want about him. He's a buffoon.
Well,
he's a racist.
That's what concerns me. That's what concerns me.
He touched Sarah, the emotional.
Sarah, go.
No.
Boy,
yell
Tim,
at me,
I'm
Sarah.
So happy you're not in studio right now.
Yell at me, Sarah.
No, I cannot get behind anybody sort of lionizing this person. And I think it's damaging for the Democrats to have her up there on stage, because it diminishes the entire process and it looks unserious. And I don't think I quite agree with your point. I will agree that it was a joyless exercise, these debates. I mean, you know, I mean,
extremely.
Republicans, you know, they will tell you all the time they didn't vote for Trump. They voted against the Democrats, and that's why they want to own the limbs. You know, Republicans really hate Democrats more than they like Trump. But last night it looked like Democrats hate Democrats. That being said, I wouldn't say that all of them aren't making the moral case. I mean, when Joe Biden, I think the problem is it sounds a little canned, but when he talks about fighting for the soul of the country, he is trying to make that moral case. And I think if he weren't up there with a bunch of people who wanted to fight about eliminating private health insurance as a means to sort of executing his candidacy by running to the left, that there would be maybe more space for them to be talking more positively and making kind of the moral case against Trump.
I guess I'd say this. I mean, if you take Marianne off the stage and you take away probably, I would say, 3% of the four debates. I agree with you. Biden had two lines. Kamala talked about looking in the mirror about who we are.
Pete had that great straight to camera going after Republicans.
The things. Right. OK, so we could think about maybe a half dozen things. But 95%, I'll up it to 5%. 95% of the debates over four nights would have been exactly the same if Mitt Romney was the president or John McCain was the president. Like, I did not feel the sense of urgency about the opponent that they're running against, the separation of his character. Of what he has done to our communities. There was no mention, I don't think, about Cory Booker only mentioned Baltimore. There was no mention about the teenager, Francisco Galicia, that was put in the cage over the course of two nights. There was no real, except for Marianne's answer about racism, like answer about what his racism has meant for our communities and how it's stoking racism in our communities. The debates felt very like emotionless with regards to Trump, with a few examples.
I have a question for all three of you about this, because this has been one of my operating theories, is that for all of the resistance talk, most Democrats don't actually view Trump any differently than they have viewed every Republican president for the last 20 years. Because if they did, then there would be like a giant move within the party to shut this nominating process down, to protect the nominee, and just like, let's just fast forward to Biden and Kamala 2020. For exactly what you said, Tim, this is you would have had 95% of these debates would have been the exact same with Romney or Jeb or John McCain as president. And to me, that has always suggested that in a weird way, it is like the Republicans like us are the only ones, Republicans like us, the Republicans like you guys, are the only ones who genuinely believe that Trump is different. Is that right, do you think, or is that not
I
right?
I think there's 10, I'll just answer really quick, sorry, you chime in, sir. I think there's 10 to 20% of the Democratic, I think there's a minority of the Democratic Party that shares that. I don't think the candidates are speaking to them, but overall, it's less people than I would have thought. And I agree with you 100%. I would have thought that this campaign would have been solely focused on that, because they would have feared a backlash among their voters if they did anything to undermine their efforts to beat Trump. And that has obviously not happened. So I was wrong about that. And I think you're right, JBL.
Yeah, I think you're mostly right. I think if you think that Trump is an existential threat, you're running a very different campaign. You're certainly not gambling on far left policies that are deeply unpopular with the vast majority of Americans. Like, you're doing a much safer thing to beat him. I don't think, though, it's that they don't think that he's an existential threat. I just don't think they've figured out how to, like, politically harness that. It's like they only know how to continue to do politics the way they've always done politics.
How do you communicate that?
Well, because it's sort of like at this point everyone knows it. And so I feel like at the same time, like, it was so strange last night to have that debate be a referendum on Barack Obama, who's widely popular with Democrats, instead of it being a referendum on Donald Trump. Like, that they are just missing the boat here on politically how you do this. But I don't think it's because they don't think that Trump is all of these things and morally degrading us. They just can't figure out how to politically pivot in the right direction. And it's because there's 20 of them, right? Like, they can't sort of consolidate into some sort of a coherent strategy.
And I think it might also be partly because they're all politicians. And this is, again, and I'll just get Sarah's blood pressure going up again, but like, why Marianne stood out. I do think it's part of the reason, because to your point, but Biden tried to do this, Booker tried to do this. It feels like there's a gap of ability for people who have like trained their brains to be on message and on talking points, to be able to step back for a second and try to actually connect with people about what they're feeling about this time in history and this time in our country. And I think that a lot of these folks are just physically incapable of doing that. Like, that it's just not in their makeup. And so maybe they want to do it more, that just aren't able to execute it.
Do you think it's authenticity? Because I think back to the, I always try and view this, because these are sort of unprecedented times, at least from a campaign aspect. But when you look at the Republican side, there are a lot of similarities. And Trump, his rawness and his authenticity is probably what propelled him. Do you think that that's also sort of the appeal of Marianne, the strange appeal of Marianne is that everyone else is like Ted Cruz. It's a chatty Cathy, clip your string, you know, just spitting out statements that their political consultants poll tested and thought worked really well. But she's the only one who is, you know, going yada, yada, yada and doing things that are authentic and not like a traditional candidate. Do you think that there's an authenticity problem?
Yes, for sure. Yeah. And I think that any of these, normal traditional politicians who are able to say, OK, I need to take a step back here and move away from, you know, the talking points and the white papers and try to actually speak to you like human to human. Would benefit by for that. It's just hard. It's harder than it sounds. You know, it's harder to make that sound authentic. You know, one of the nice things that one of the things that Trump has going for him is he just didn't care about any of the rules. He didn't care about any of the norms. Like, he's authentic in this weird way, right? He's lying all the time, so he's not like really authentic. But he has a kind of persona that is not scripted. Right.
Well,
so
people he's always been lying all the time. So it's,
right.
It's,
so people
it's
read that
he's an
as
authentic,
authentic
liar.
Liar. Right. Yeah. So people read it as authentic. That's not scripted. It is hard to script a non-scripted sounding moment. You know what I mean? Like, hey, I know I heard from somebody. I made this similar point to what we're discussing a couple of days ago. I heard from somebody on one of the campaigns that said, I agree. We're trying to do that. But it's hard. You know, you're sitting around a room with six consultants and they're like,
people
you really need to connect
fight.
With people.
They
on want this to
know how
anecdote.
To put food on their tables.
Yeah.
You get
it's
stuff
hard.
Like that. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. It gets watered down. And so, you know, and that's why if you go back and remember memorable moments, they were all actually not scripted. You know, it's like Hillary crying in New Hampshire. That was the thing that worked for her. The consultants didn't tell her to cry. So, I mean, this is a little bit easier said than done.
So, Tim, what you're saying is that the problem is always the candidates.
No, the consultants are not great in a lot of these cases either. You know, I'm sure, and certainly myself included.
Sarah, you look like you are just sickened by us.
No, I guess I was thinking about this idea that because there's no doubt, I can't tell whether the Marianne Williamson moment is because so many people were sort of joking about her and think it's funny. I don't know that I sort of buy where Tim's going, that like actually she tapped into something bigger and deeper. That being said, I do think her sort of breaking out does underscore what I think is the weakness of this field. I mean, to have so many people in it and to have nobody that seems to be capturing the imagination at all. I mean, the best pitch you've got really is either burn it all down, restructure the whole system, or you've got Joe Biden's kind of return to normalcy. Don't worry, I'll just steady things out. And neither of those things get people's blood pumping, other than when it means that Donald Trump will no longer be president.
Can I just really quick, who can fill a stadium here? Warren, maybe only. Right?
No, and so Bernie can, and when he
still
when he's the nominee, Biden will.
Speaking of filling stadiums and authentic things, Jonathan, what are you wearing right now?
Oh, I am wearing an authentic.
That was an interesting. Hey,
game
you up,
worn,
JVL?
Game worn Philadelphia Phillies flex based uniform worn by the Philly skipper, Gabe Kepler. It's great. It's got a snot stain on the elbow, on the sleeve where he wiped his nose. It's pretty awesome.
Did you win that in like a some sort of raffle?
No, I paid money for this. Are you a baseball guy or are you just a basketball guy? Because you're
basketball and football. Once you become an adult, you know.
I thought you were a big Oakland A's guy.
Yeah, no, I've been to a couple A's games because you know they're fun. But I still could only name up. I don't know if I can name any players. I've given up basketball and football. You only have so much time. I mean, what my poor husband has to already watch 82 Nuggets games and 16 Broncos games.
All right, we can't talk about sports ball or Sarah's going to leave.
No, that's not it. I just, here's the thing. This is what I don't understand about sports. It's like, you paid money for a shirt that has snot on it. Like, I don't understand adult men. Why?
I'm not an adult.
I think it's pretty cool.
Well, it's, you know, like the same reason why people buy used socks. I mean,
is that a thing people do?
In Japan, and they buy used other things too. Then this is a family podcast, and we're not going to talk about that.
I would definitely buy game-worn Grant Delpit LSU anything, snot on it, whatever. Blood on it, would not care. I would be in the market for that. So I can relate.
I just want to say one political thing before we finally adjourn this. I'm actually going to go the other way on the impressiveness of the Democratic field. In a field of 20 candidates, Biden is getting almost a third already. I think that is a marker of tremendous strength. It is really, really hard to crack 30% when you have 20 candidates running. And although we've got, you know, five who are top tier, the middle tier people, if we had talked 4 years ago and said Cory Booker and Kirsten Gillibrand and Amy Klobuchar and John Hickenlooper and Michael Bennet and talked to them, we would not have automatically assumed that they were also Rands. Right. We would have said, well, maybe they pop, maybe they don't. But it's not you wouldn't have to squint to see them at 7%.
Here's the thing, though, JB. Like, we're not electing a prime minister. I wish we were, you know. I wish that, you know, Michael Bennet would win the presidency and then, you know, Paul Ryan would have been the next person to, you know, be coronated on our side. Like, that's you know, how the system kind of used to work. There's some good arguments for that. That's not how it works in presidential campaigns anymore. You know, I mean, just look at everybody, really, from Reagan forward, with the exception of H.W. Bush, has massive charisma.
Yeah, what I'm saying is I think Biden has that. I think we're just not appreciating it yet.
Right. So maybe I think that Biden is deeply underappreciated. None of those other people do.
Yeah.
There's nobody else on stage who has major charisma. I think Kamala has shown it in flashes. Warren has shown it in flashes. So maybe we'll think differently in a year. But the rest of that field doesn't, except Marianne.
Yeah, I think that's a good point, Tim. And when it becomes a two-person race, and if it is Biden, we will appreciate the charisma all the more because he will be so much more likable than Trump will. With that, we're going to end the podcast here. We want to thank our sponsor, NetSuite by Oracle, and we want to thank Tim for coming. Tim, thanks for making the time, man.
Megacast. Anytime.
They're the best. And we appreciate you listening. Remember, five-star reviews do help our rating on Apple, and we hope you will do that if you have not done it already. We will be back tomorrow where we'll do this all over again.